Have you or someone you know suffered from a herniated lumbar disc? With over 3 million U.S. cases per year, lumbar disc herniation is among the most common injuries affecting U.S. adults. It may cause debilitating pain affecting activities of daily living and quality of life. Imagine having surgery to treat this debilitating pain only to have the symptoms return a few weeks or months later. It's more common than you think. However, there is a technology which allows surgeons to reduce spinal reoperations for reherniation by 81% in indicated patients. Keep listening to learn more from neurosurgeon Dr. Betsy Grunch as she shares information about a novel treatment option designed to make the first spine surgery the last surgery and save the healthcare system unnecessary costs.
My name is Betsy Grunch. I am a board-certified neurosurgeon in Gainesville, Georgia at the Longstreet Clinic. I did my undergraduate degree in biology from the University of Georgia. I got my MD degree at Medical College of Georgia, and then I went to Duke for my neurosurgery training with an enfolded spine fellowship at that time. And when I finished residency, I joined the Longstreet Clinic in 2013 as a neurosurgeon here. I practice general neurosurgery, but the focus of my practice is spine surgery for the most part. I do about 95% spine surgery, and I have been here for 8 years now.
And then can you explain to me just some of the symptoms and causes of lumbar disc herniation?
Sure. A lumbar disc herniation is where a disc in the lumbar spine can protrude and impinge upon a nerve that can cause radicular pain, or in other words, back pain that can radiate down the leg in a certain distribution depending on which nerve is impinged in the back. A disc herniation can arise from a variety of sources, such as a lifting injury or an axial load type injury, or could happen from a chronic annular tear in which a disc can protrude through that tear and impinge upon the nerve.
And then how do you typically treat a lumbar disc herniation? How soon would you see that patient in when they develop pain?
So typically we treat lumbar radiculopathy conservatively. So a patient that's symptomatic of a lumbar disc herniation will often seek treatment initially from their primary care doctor and initiate a plan of conservative treatment. Typically that will consist of physical therapy, anti-inflammatory medications. If their patient's pain is persistent, despite those initial steps of conservative treatment, then typically an MRI scan is ordered, which would confirm the diagnosis of a disc herniation. At that point, they're typically referred to a surgical practice or a spine practice for ongoing treatments. Other treatments would be injections such as selected nerve root blocks and or epidural injections into the back to see if it would help with the patient's pain. And if that patient fails those conservative treatment steps, often they're considered to be a candidate for a discectomy.
And then what is that standard discectomy procedure? How does that treat the symptoms?
So a lumbar microdiscectomy is where a surgeon, typically a neurosurgeon or an orthopedic spine surgeon, would go in and remove fragments of disc that may be protruding and causing pressure on the nerve.
And then, so what would you expect the best outcome to be for a patient who undergoes a discectomy?
So best case scenario in someone that undergoes a microdiscectomy is that, you know, once the pressure is removed off of that nerve, sometimes almost instantaneously when they wake up from surgery, since there's no more pressure on the nerve, that their radicular pain and back pain is gone.
And when you talk to your patients about lumbar discectomy, what risks do you tell them there is from having that surgery?
So when I educate a patient on any surgical procedure, including a microdiscectomy, there are standard risks of any surgery. Those include general anesthetic, bleeding, infection, and those kinds of things, which are low, but definitely something that we mention to every patient that undergoes surgery. But more prominently, and what I educate patients on, is the chance of a recurrent disc herniation. So what that means is when we remove a portion of the disc, we do have to go through a tear in the annulus to deflate the disc, to remove the pressure off the nerve. And that hole is something that is often challenging to repair primarily. So that annular defect would have to kind of scar over on its own. Oftentimes, patients can experience a reherniation, and depending on the size of that tear, their risk of reherniation varies. But we have them on pretty modified restrictions after surgery to reduce that risk, at least in the initial postoperative phase.
So you can't tell whether or not a patient has a large hole or defect in their annulus after their microdiscectomy prior to surgery. It has to happen during surgery.
That is correct. It's the imaging capabilities is not, you're not able to really measure the size of an annular defect prior to surgery. And that's something that's typically measured intraoperatively.
Can you describe the barricade technology really in its treatment of patients or in its potential benefit to patients with these large annular defects?
So I mentioned that when a patient undergoes a discectomy surgery, that there is an annular defect or a hole in the disc. And that size of that really depends on what may be present at the time going into surgery. So one of the risks is reherniation of the disc from that persistent annular defect that is often challenging to repair primarily. The barricade technology is a device that can assist a surgeon with primary annular closure in order to reduce those risks of reherniation in a patient that has a large annular tear. So essentially what would happen is that annular defect is measured during the operation to determine whether or not the barricade technology is suitable for that patient to reduce their rate of reherniation. That implant is sized and placed during the time of the primary discectomy surgery in order to kind of close off that annular defect to reduce their rate of reherniation.
And then have you used other annular closure technologies in the past? And if so, how does barricade differ from those?
Other annular closure devices that I have tried in the past is the X-Close device. That is a suture type device in which you deploy a suture into the annulus in attempts of closing the annulus by sewing it together. That type of technology is often challenging only because the annulus often is not a very suturable type material, and the annulus has to be amenable to holding a stitch and holding the back of the stitch into place to secure it. So in cases where I've used the X-Close device, I would say only 20 to 30% of the time, even by opening the implant and utilizing the implant, that I can actually get it to sew the annular defect closed. So the barricade device is a totally different type of device in which it uses a bone anchor, which is a lot more stable and a lot easier for the surgeon because it kind of plugs that hole by anchoring into the bone itself.
How do you select those patients? How do you identify those patients both before surgery and then during surgery?
So a patient would be a potential candidate for a barricade implant preoperatively if they are undergoing a microdiscectomy procedure. Typically, the only thing that I can measure preoperatively to determine whether or not they would be a candidate for a barricade is the height of the disc. So oftentimes, patients that have a very collapsed disc or under 4 millimeters height, we would know prior to surgery that would not be amenable to a barricade device intraoperatively. But outside of that, typically there's not a good way of measuring or determining with reasonable certainty that a patient would be, you know, a candidate for barricade. So I consider every patient with a disc height of greater than 4 millimeters and undergoing a microdiscectomy a potential candidate for a barricade pending intraoperative assessment.
And then who is able to implant a barricade?
A barricade implant is typically placed during a microdiscectomy procedure by a spine surgeon, in other words, a neurosurgeon or an orthopedic spine surgeon. These are not devices that are placed by someone such as a pain management provider.
Dr. Grunsch, you can imagine that any payer or hospital system would be nervous when new technology comes out that it's going to be overutilized. Do you worry that there's a potential for overutilization of the Barricade device?
I think it's reasonable for a carrier to be concerned about overutilization of new technology. I think that this type of implant is kind of self-selected to certain surgeons that are proactive about annular closure, and not every spine surgeon will want to implement this into their practice just based on, you know, it is a few extra steps into the procedure in which, you know, some surgeons may naturally select them into not wanting to utilize this type of technology. You will find that certain surgeons are more proactive on utilizing the technology, but those still, and such as in my practice, these patients are naturally deselected during intraoperative findings. And I find that even patients that I think may be amenable to Barricade, I find that only 20 to 30% of the time I actually end up implanting the device. And really what determines that, again, is not only the intraoperative measurements that we spoke about, but an anatomical access to that area and challenges that may be related to taking down a little bit more bone to get to that area. That I just don't feel like is advantageous to pursue implantation of the device.
Dr. Grunsch, can you talk to me a little bit about the clinical data that's been published to support the safety and efficacy of Barricade?
Yeah, Barricade is one of the most studied devices in the spine. You can combine the results from seven distinct patient populations. It shows an 80% reduction in the rate of reoperation to treat re-herniation. And this is compared to primary discectomy alone. This includes two randomized controlled clinical trials. And there is a published meta-analysis of over 800 patients as well. Combine that with real-world experience and an ISAS that's published the guidelines to support the use of a bone anchor device. There's also health technology assessments from the ECRI and HAES, and these can be found on the Barricade website.
Can you talk to me a little bit about your real-world experience in patients who you treated with Barricade and then patients that you weren't able to treat with Barricade?
Yes, I have implanted numerous Barricade devices, and I have noticed, at least in my practice and in my hands, a significant reduction in the rate of my re-herniation as compared to those patients that I was unable to implant the device. I think, you know, the risk and benefit clearly are favored towards implanting the device because a patient that does experience a re-herniation, not only is it time off of work, time out of commission from their family, but financially speaking, to undergo a repeat revision microdiscectomy versus disc replacement versus fusion is tremendously higher cost on the healthcare system and the patient's insurance payer as compared to what it would be if the Barricade was suitable for implantation from the start.
Thank you for listening. You won't want to miss the next episode as Dr. Betsy Grunsch shares her real-world experience. She will discuss indicated patients who could have benefited from a treatment designed to prevent reoperation. If you know someone who could benefit from this information, please share this podcast with them. See you next time.